Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by Winamp for Android, the ultimate media player for your desktop and Android device, featuring wireless sync. Download it free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at cachefly.com.
This is TWiT, episode 287, recorded February 6th, 2011. Finkenstein's Monster. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID, audible_com. And by GoToMyPC. Skip the rush hour traffic and save time, money, and frustration by working from home with GoToMyPC. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomypc.com/twit. And by squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free 14-day trial, go to squarespace.com/twit. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, and I am not Leo Laporte. Leo Laporte is hanging with the penguins. He's on a 3-week cruise. It's a geek cruise, right? And they're headed to Antarctica. So we actually got to say Leo's out to sea and mean it literally. I will be filling in for him on TWiT for the next 3 weeks, as well as on a few of the other shows. And we got a great panel joining us today. Patrick Norton, host of TechZilla Revision 3, and of course, longtime original TWiT man.
Original.
OT.
Old school TWiT member. Actually, I'm probably the least interesting person on today's panel by far.
I don't know about that, but we do have some really interesting folks. Also joining us, Harry McCracken, editor of Technologizer. He also writes for Time Magazine.
Hey, Tom.
Right?
That's right. The magazine and Time.com.
Excellent. Great to have you here as well, Harry. And joining us, because there is some news that Danny helped spread around, Danny Sullivan, editor-in-chief of SearchEngineLand.com. Great to have you on the show, especially
Thanks
with the news
me.
This week about Google and Bing.
Sure. Looking forward to the show.
All right. Let's get right into it. I want to start off just looking at the week ahead, because we've got a veritable avalanche of announcements next week. There's big events. Something happening every day. Monday, did you guys see this? Did you get the invite from Sprint? They promise an industry first. And they're also bringing David Blaine on stage.
What? That would be a first right there.
Well, there you go. CEO Dan Hess of Sprint will be joining David Blaine. What could they possibly have on Monday that would be an industry first? Any guesses? Not a one. It's not an iPhone. Because
it might be a 4G device of some sort. But
I was going to say a 4G device with more than 2 hours battery life. Not that I'm bitter about my overdrive modem and its overheating issues. Android on a tablet, a secret Sprint tablet they didn't mention at CES.
Galaxy tablet. I mean, that really wouldn't. I got to figure that this industry first is going to be a technicality. Industry first. We're not going to get blown away, are we?
If you're going to get blown away, they wouldn't need David Blaine. You know what I mean? Like, the whole idea is like, we've got something mind-bending that's going to change mobile communications forever. And we got this jackass who's going to, you know. What did Engadget say? You know, sit in ice water with flesh-rending animals for 45 minutes. Hey, you know, it's not like Hess doesn't know how to give a good press conference. I mean, he's not Steve Jobs. Nobody is. So if they actually need a giant scary magician on stage to spice things up, I'm a little confused and possibly bored already.
Harry, do you have any insight into what this might be?
You know, if we're blown away, we'll really be blown away because we're not sure what it is. So my guess is it's either something relatively mundane or something completely out of the blue, and probably the former.
much more exciting, probably, will be Julian Assange's extradition hearing, which is set to begin Monday and Tuesday. I'm sure C-SPAN will give you live wall-to-wall coverage, or somebody will. But this is where they're trying to extradite him to Sweden to face the charges on sexual harassment, sexual assault charges over there. Really doesn't have anything to do with WikiLeaks, but it's the reason he's been under house arrest. Because Sweden wants him to be pulled over. And a lot of people think if he gets extradited to Sweden, it'll be easy for the United States to get Sweden to extradite him to the United States to face charges on WikiLeaks. So this whole thing's about to start heating back up.
Which is really stupid, by the way, because if the U.S. wants to extradite him, they can get him out of the U.K. quite easily. There's there's any number of people who are upset that it's very easy to extradite from the U.K. to the U.S. So, there's lots of conspiracies going on, but the idea that the U.S. needs to get him to Sweden to then get him out to the U.S., they could just do it straight through the U.K. They don't need to go through Scandinavia as part of this.
Probably the least exciting announcement coming is on Tuesday. Dell just picked a bad week. They've got a Dell Means Business event in San Francisco, and it's my guess that it's, you know, some sort of business enterprise related stuff, but it's not going to be exciting for the consumer.
Well, they did have a 10-inch tablet they held up at Dell's CES presentation, literally for almost 30 seconds at the waist of the CEO all the way up on stage, and basically said they would be talking more about it later in the year. So could be the 10-inch tablet they were showing off there. And then after that, it's like, yeah, business usually means server and long-term sort of not changing a lot desktops. So
Wednesday's the one. Oh, go ahead. Okay, Wednesday is HP planning a WebOS event. I'm actually excited about this. We're going to see tablets. We're going to see probably some new phones, right, Harry?
I certainly hope so. I'm going to be there, and I'm going to be live blogging it. And even though we know it's WebOS, it seems like there's a lot we don't know, like how many products. There were rumors before that nothing might show up until September, which seemed unlikely. And then HP kind of said, don't believe everything you saw out there. So I think given that we know the general topic, I think there's still a lot of unknowns, and I'm kind of eager to see a tablet operating system that's not from Apple and is not from Google. I think there's should be room for at least one more good product, and HP has as good a shot as anybody.
Can HP make any headway against Apple? I mean, I guess it's a question of anybody can, but a lot of people think the Motorola Zoom is the best one for this. Can HP revive WebOS as a tablet operating system?
It needs to be revived because, the Palm Pre was a really good product, which did not do well. And then it's been, I don't even know how long it's been since there was a really significant upgrade to any device based on that platform. We basically had the Pre and the Pre Plus and the Pre 2, whatever it's called, and the Pixie. So they lost a lot of time, and they kind of have to reboot the whole product line. But I'd like to see it happen.
The rest of this week, we've got other things to talk about later bearing on them. For instance, the Verizon iPhone goes on sale on Thursday. We got some news to talk about regarding that. Friday, Nokia has its capital markets meeting. There's a lot of rumors about what's going to happen, what announcements new CEO Stephen Elop might make. We'll talk about that a little while later as well. And then next Sunday, Mobile World Congress kicks off in Barcelona. Samsung's got their big announcements leading up to the beginning of Mobile World Congress later in the week. Anybody going to MWC? Harry, you're not going out?
Not this year. I went a couple of years ago and had fun, and I ate really well, but I'm not going this year.
They have excellent jamón in Barcelona, let me tell you. My wife is going to Madrid on an unrelated thing, and I'm trying to figure out how I can convince her to smuggle ham out of the country. I mean, in today's immigration environment, it's probably not a wise idea, though. I may have to just live without it. All right, let's get to the big news of the week. And Danny, I'll let you tell us the most about this, but just to set the stage, it started with, for me anyway, I saw your post on Search Engine Land about how Google was claiming Bing was copying search results. And you had a great layout of exactly what was going on and what they found.
Sure. So I'll back up a bit more. You know, we've had this whole thing heating up over the past month now where Google in particular, its relevancy of its results have come under attack. A number of people have written articles since the beginning of the year. We had one that came up in somewhere around the middle of January, I think it was January 12th, and I got a call from Google saying, hey, we really want you to come in and talk more about relevancy issues or whatever. So I said, okay, right. Set up a time to come in at the end of January. This was the 28th is when I went in. So this was like two Fridays ago. Go in, have a bunch of meetings. I usually, if I'm off of Google, meet with a bunch of different product people and understand different things that are going on. Last meeting of the day, they come in. So we want to talk to you about this thing. And they start showing me these results and this testing that they've been doing that is convincing them that Bing is copying all their search results. They had noticed somewhere around the middle of last year that Bing's results sometimes seem to be very similar to theirs, uncannily similar in some cases. They'd do a spelling correction that they'd consider to be really difficult to know that somebody had typed something in and it should have been another word instead, and they would correct it. And then they would see Bing doing the same thing, and it's got the engineers kind of scratching their head. Then they saw more sort of anecdotal results of this, and around October they noticed a jump in two statistics that made them think that Bing was becoming more Google-like. They noticed that Bing seemed to have a higher percentage of results in its first page that matched Google's results. And they also noticed that there was a higher percentage of the number one results that were matching on Bing that were also matching on Google. So Google, which is, I think, always had kind of a very low opinion of Microsoft, kind of used them as this evil empire they've got to fight against, started thinking, wow, are they actually somehow mining our search results? And in particular, are they doing it using Internet Explorer, using things like the Bing toolbar, using the suggested sites feature that will send information back? So they set up a sting operation.
Some kind of movie set sort of, you know. Tail. I can't wait for the made for YouTube video of this.
It's funny because, you know, I've taken heat in some quarters or, well, how could you tell this story, or, you know, how were you convinced by Google? It's like, I'm sorry. One of the world's biggest technology operations, like, sets up a Hollywood-style sting operation. I mean, that was just, like, a great story regardless of whatever happens, right? So they set up this sting operation where they get 100 searches that don't really exist in nature, very unusual words that nobody searches on that don't bring up any results or really poor results. And then they alter their search code so that for the first time, they say, they could now manually put a website at the top of these results.
They spiked their results.
They spiked their results for these really 100 unusual queries. And they do this in the middle of December. They send these engineers home from Google with Internet Explorer, and they say, go through, do this search on Google, click on the top result, and we'll see what happens. They do this, and 2 weeks later, 9 of the queries on Bing start generating the same result as Google has. So it's pretty clear Bing got that information by watching someone who was searching on Google, the Google engineers in this case, and, you know, had their results appearing that way. You know, to Google, this was a clear case that Bing was copying their information. So I went back to Bing. I talked to him on a Friday. On the Monday morning, I said to Bing, like, Google saying this stuff, let's talk about it. Bing had their big event on Tuesday. I can't remember what it's called, like Farsight 2011.
Yeah, Farsight 2011. And exactly. Matt Cutts from Google and Harry Shum were scheduled to be on stage together.
Right. And so Bing knew this was coming up. I mean, Google knew this was coming up, and, you know, they were going to want to talk about it at that thing anyway. So I'm like, okay, you guys want to tell me the story? All right, I'll write it up. That's interesting. I'll see what Bing has to say with it. And Bing's response was basically, yeah, we do get information in the way that Google's suggesting. We get information from a lot of sources, and we want to talk about it more after Tuesday's event is over. So I'm like, okay, write up, you know, what I could tell of it, try to explain what Bing is saying. Spend a lot of time, I thought, mentioning that, you know, from what you can see, it's not that Bing's results are an identical copy of Google's, but that in some of these very unusual cases, some of this work that Google's doing is going to cause Bing to be doing the same thing. And that's the crux of what Google feels is unfair. They think that they work really hard in these particularly niche areas and that Bing's results will improve. So the event happens, and the story went out. The event happens, and the proverbial is hitting the fan everywhere. And Bing's response came back, and I did a follow up article that ran on this Friday. Was really, we gather information from all over the web that our users are going to. Google is part of that. Sure, we get a signal of what people are searching on Google, but that's not the only thing that we see. We see it from other places. We're not specifically targeting Google. And these are really outlier cases. And in fact, you can take Google's own test and flip it around, because they ran 100 queries and only 9 of them, in a worst case scenario, the worst case that you could pick, where the only signal, if you will, was coming from Google, was flowing in, and in most of the cases, Bing didn't use it. So they're split apart. Google feels like basically Bing is cherry-picking their best stuff. Bing's response is, we hardly use this search signal from across the web. It's really, really minor. There's nothing wrong with looking what our users are doing when they're using our browser and improving search results. And in fact, we think that you do the same thing as well, Google. And that's where the standoff remains.
And there's been plenty of aftershocks from Microsoft all week in reaction. I mean, they are sniping at each other in the press, essentially, where Microsoft is trying to reiterate, we do not copy these results, which I find both sides of this very odd from a public relations standpoint, don't you? I mean, first of all, why does Google want to make such a big deal about this? It almost gives Bing more publicity than it hurts them.
Well, there's a lot of people who I think are overreading some of the PR. There's definitely PR. Both companies are putting spins on this. But to me, the fundamental thing is that on the Google side, you have engineers that feel like something fundamentally unfair is happening, that they're really upset about it. They feel like they've worked very, very hard on this stuff, and that Bing is doing something that's just wrong and, unethical or just unfair.
So basically, they feel like they worked at Overture?
Yeah. I suppose you could say the same sort of thing. That's sort of some of the irony. I mean, the reference is, Google just copied Overture's paid ads, and Google copies everything. And in fact, Google's entire business model is arguably based on copying stuff from all over the place and making it easier for people to locate things. I don't think the Google engineers are looking that far into it, right? I think the Google engineers that were upset were just saying, we think this is so unfair. And we have this evidence, and I keep likening it as if they walked into the UN of the web and they said, we have found the Bing missile sites, and we need your support. And they didn't get it because, some people actually look at what Bing's doing and think, well, that's kind of reasonable. And some people just have a lot of hostility towards Google, and it's, exactly that. Well, you're fine copying everybody. Who cares if they do it? And it doesn't seem like it's mattering that much. And on Bing's side, you have the same degree of engineers that have actually worked very hard to improve their search results who are not happy at all over the idea that Google wants to suggest that, they're just doing it because they copy Google.
Is this an indication of the way a Larry Page-led Google is apt to react, allowing the engineers to have their head and raise these sorts of things? Is this something where, I mean, I know Eric Schmidt is still CEO for a couple other weeks, but is this something that he might have tried to put a damper on?
No, I don't think that any of the top execs, if Larry was fully in charge right now, I don't know that this would have made a difference. I think that, Google looked at this sort of thing in general and was reacting to the engineers. I don't see it as, this is because Page was there or because he's not there. The best example you could see is if you go back to around 2005, when Yahoo announced that for the first time they had a web page index that was bigger than Google. And Google went nuts. They like lost their minds and spent the next month trying to dispute all the Yahoo stats, and they're not bigger than us, and we've got to talk to these people. We need to, explain more about that. And in the end, it just kind of ended in this stalemate where Google said, we're bigger, but we're not going to put numbers up anymore.
So in a way, what you're saying is Google is less concerned with PR and more concerned with just being right.
Yeah. And the problem is that what they, I think, believe so firmly that they're right that they forget that not everybody's going to agree with that.
Or care.
Yeah. In this case, they don't really care that much. It wasn't this sort of big convincing case. I mean, it's been interesting watching the reaction, because there have been some people who are, you know, clearly, well, Bing, you suck, and I suspected this, and now I think you're spying on us, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a whole lot of people who just don't have any sympathy for what Google's saying, and that they, you know, took a hit on this as well. And it certainly did not go the way that I think Google thought it was going to go, which was, okay, we've got the coalition of everybody. we're going up against it. It's like they've got a coalition of, you know, kind of Google.
Yeah, the coalition of the willing to be assimilated by Google.
Right.
Hey, Danny, to be super Machiavellian about this, do you think part of Google's willing to go on and on about Bing's copying our search results, could that have been in part because of the battle they're in right now with the content farms and trying to bring up the quality of search?
I mean, that's been one of the things that have gone around, that, well, they're doing this whole thing to distract from the fact that, hey, everybody says their results suck now. So, and possibly, you know, I mean, it certainly is distracting from that argument. Those arguments will come back. But to concoct all of this, they would have had to know, first of all, that was all going to explode, in January, right?
And they started doing these test pages in December, right?
Right. You know, so, you know, maybe they had a hint that that was going to happen. So they got all this stuff together. Maybe they're lying about the timing, you know. And then they were also looking into some of this stuff back in October when relatively few people were talking about it. We've had a real frenzy over the past month. Now, they could have sat on it even longer. But, you know, I just haven't seen the timing as this is what they're doing. What I will say is that I think they are reacting to some of the people suggesting, as our article did, that the results are not that different. And I think this was them kind of throwing up their hands saying, all right, you think the results aren't that different? Maybe it has something to do with the fact that Bing's just copying us, right? you know, that's, I think, their reaction was, if we want to start talking about relevancy and who's better, who's worse, then we need to fill you in on some things that we haven't talked about before. You know, I hope we do get back to the relevancy issues. I think that, you know, both Bing and Google have challenges that they're going at. And, you know, this has distracted from that, but I don't think it's going to make that go away.
I think it's, you know, it's interesting because they're trying to say they're playing a little bit of a political game here, saying they're copying search results. And that's not even actually what Google is accusing them of. They're accusing them of using Google search results to, you know, improve their own. And I don't necessarily think that that's such a bad thing. I mean, if you can use your algorithm in a way to look at what other behaviors other websites are doing, is that unethical? I mean, because a lot of the early conversation about this was like, it's unethical for them to do that. But isn't that what every search engine does, is goes out and it indexes the web?
Well, that's part of the whole argument that's going on. And Bing's argument is this is an important signal, and why wouldn't we be using it? And in fact, in my original article, I said it was very clever. You know, why wouldn't you do that if you could use this information? I suppose the reasons why you might not want to do it, or that you might think perhaps it's unethical, is that, first of all, Bing has said that there is a search signal that they gather from across the web. And Google is going to be the heaviest component of that search signal. You know, they're kind of drowning it out, you know, the other stuff that's going on. You know, potentially searches on Amazon are mixed in there, and eBay and so on. I think that you got two other things that happen, that in these very isolated cases where Google has actually come up with a great spelling correction that's produced better results, it's not really the user behavior that's causing Bing to see that and improve on its end. It's not like the user corrected the spelling. All the user effectively does in some of these niche cases is act as a channel to tell Bing what Google's doing. You know, they didn't come up with a better way to do the spelling. They just saw that Google did it. So that's one of those cases. That's where I probably feel the most sympathy for Google, which is, okay, you know, you say it's really hard to come up with these spelling corrections, and now you should see that Bing is doing the same thing. It would be the equivalent, I suppose, of coming up with an interesting blog post idea and writing it, and then somebody else comes along and then writes it themselves and doesn't give you any credit for it. But, you know, Bing's argument of we're looking at all these signals from all over the place, and that's what people do on the web. And in fact, we think Google's doing it as well. You know, that holds a lot of water.
Is Google better than Bing?
We don't. Nobody knows. We don't know. We don't have any independent relevancy statistics to tell us this. And in fact, some of the people who have been arguing over this past month that Google has gotten worse and everything sucks, they don't know that. That's all just people's guts feelings. I think people are better recognizing when they see the same kind of content farm material showing up. But yeah, I think they're also forgetting that before they did those searches and before all the content farms were there, they probably just got pure spam. You know, there probably wasn't good answers coming up either. So we don't really know.
I think quantifying search results is enormously difficult. But when I find myself over the course of, say, 6 months, you know, on stuff I constantly search about, suddenly finding more and more, you know, eHow associated content, basically garbage results, nothing personal to anybody who works on those sites. But, you know, when I'm looking at an article and literally it looks like something, a weak form of AI cobbled together from search results to generate more search results and more internal links, you know, the search results before that and after that, if they're not sort of pushed down below the fold, may still be really, really good. But it's gotten to the point where it's like, I keep thinking like, wow, you know, we really need a button where we can vote up and vote down on the quality of these answers. You know, I know Google doesn't want a human element in its algorithm other than the creation of the algorithm itself. But, you know, it seems like there's always this kind of arms race between people gaming the Google algorithm and, you know, the team. I assume Matt Cutts kind of still runs the team that's sort of fighting back and forth to find some parity between people gaming the system and the system giving the best possible results. But it just seems like there's been a lot more noise in the results than there was a year ago or 6 months ago.
Which search engine do you all use most of the time? I mean, I know everybody probably uses different ones at different times, but Harry, what search engine do you use?
You know, I generally use Google, and when I go to Bing, I find it not to be as good, but I kind of wonder whether that's because I've used Google for so long that my brain has trained itself to think like Google does, if that makes sense. I also know that Google does something, which I know Danny has written about, which is, without telling you, it tweaks the order of the results a lot based on what it knows about what you searched for. So I see sites I go to a lot, such as my own site, way up high in Google, which gives me a warm and fuzzy feeling. And I see less of that with Bing, probably partially because I don't use Bing as much. I think the world thinks like Google does, which gives Google an advantage right now. And I read a lot about this stuff with content farms, to be honest. If I do searches with an aim of finding bad content farm stuff in there, it comes up. And I'm just using Google the way I usually do searches. It hasn't been a huge issue.
And Danny, I assume you use every search engine that's out there, but is there one that you primarily use? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I primarily use Google like most people do. It tends to be what my default's on. I keep reminding myself that I've got to change the default every other day just so I'm getting more of a variety. But, you know, it still works well. I encountered the same kind of problems that people do when they see the noise. It's especially hard for me when I do searches on Google because I always liken it back to that scene in The Matrix when what's-his-name was there and he's got those three screens, it's all computer code, and he goes, I just see blonde, redhead, and brunette or whatever.
Oh, right, right.
When I look at search results, I'm seeing all the SEO or I'm seeing all the errors even more strongly than, you know, a typical person would perhaps look at, because I'll see what may be influencing or not influencing it. And I would agree. I think anecdotally for me, the noise has gotten worse on Google. I don't know that it's necessarily better than on Bing. I've seen people talk about, well, how Blecko is, you know, great and it's got this great solution. And I love Blecko being there, but it's not hard for me to go to Blecko and come up with really bad results as well. So I think, you know, it's not. And I think that they all have a lot of challenges on what they're dealing with, this new stream of content that's coming in, which is not spam, which is what they used to have to fight with. It's just, and it's not necessarily bad quality. I mean, you get a lot of, say, these eHow things, because in the past when you would search in the form of a question or whatever, there really didn't seem to be much content. So now people are becoming very sophisticated about getting something that's sometimes it just is sort of like fast food like out there rather than the meal you were perhaps looking for. And I think that's what they're struggling with now. How do we decide what's good quality versus noise and then try to get the good quality up there?
It is kind of amazing that we're having a conversation about what the best search engine is. It reminds me, it puts me in the mind of the fact that Internet Explorer is now, what, 56% of market share, where it used to be unthinkable that there would be another browser. Even a year or two ago, the idea that you'd even talk about anything but Google in search engines is sort of unthinkable. But not only are we talking about Google and Bing, we're talking about things like Blecko and there's another one, Duck. Something that I can't remember.
DuckDuckGo.
DuckDuckGo, which I saw a billboard for them today, which kind of amazed me.
Is Google threatened even in the tiniest bit? Is that why they're so reactive to this? Do they feel the heat for the first time in what actually makes them all their money, which is ads on search?
Right. I think they are. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Yes, they're probably feeling more heat than they've ever felt before or for a very, very long time. I remember they used to be an underdog, so there was heat. But from a consumer point of view, most consumers don't really seem to have a problem. I mean, we talk about a lot of this stuff in the blogosphere or whatever, but, you know, their market share continues to be very strong. They occasionally have a, you know, 1-point drop here or there, and then they come back up. And for the most part, Bing really just seemed to be, you know, cannibalizing Yahoo search traffic. In terms of mind share, I think that it's a much different story. They've got a stronger competitor now that they're facing, and they've got people, you know, who are in the technological space who are questioning whether or not they really are as superior as they were in the past. And they don't like that. It's funny because Google loves to say, we're not big, we're not a monopoly, people could switch at any time, and if they will, they'll do it or whatever. And in fact, it works to their advantage sometime, and they'll highlight that they're not the biggest search engine or that Bing's coming along, because then they can even say to the people in D.C. and elsewhere, see, we have all this competition, you don't need to regulate us. But if you start questioning their technological chops, they don't like that. That really just brings out the whole, all right, we're going to have to fight back and show you, you know, that we really do think we're the best thing that's out there.
A bit sensitive about that. Harry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I think perception is incredibly important. I think about Dell, but back in the 90s, Dell had an amazing halo as a PC company based on, at least for quite a while, having really good tech support. And then their tech support got bad, and the halo not only disappeared, Dell acquired sort of a negative halo with a lot of people, where I think people assume that if you call Dell for tech support, you would get somebody in another country who couldn't help you. And Google, for the longest time, has had, you know, one of the greatest halos there ever was in technology, just in terms of almost everybody assuming that because it was Google, it was good. And if I were at Google, I'd be really worried about the potential for that to crumble, because I think it can happen pretty quickly when it does.
All right, we're going to move on to a few other topics. Google had their Honeycomb announcement. The Daily came out from Rupert Murdoch. I want to thank one of our sponsors, Audible.com. They provide us with over 85,000 downloadable titles in audio form. And I'm getting addicted to where I almost don't want to read a book if it's not available in audio, because it's so much more convenient. I can clean the house. I can mow the lawn. Actually, I don't mow the lawn, but I can walk the dogs. I don't have enough of a lawn to mow. But, you know, I can do all kinds of things and be reading books. I've plowed through the first 4 volumes of Stephen King's Dark Tower, just driving back and forth to work and doing chores and jogging and stuff like that. So if you'd like to try out Audible, we can give you 2 free audiobooks right here on Twit. Go to audible.com/Twit and the number 2, Twit 2, and you get 2 free audiobooks under their platinum offer. I'm going to recommend, just because of our conversation here, John Battelle's The Search. If you want to learn a little bit about how Google became Google, John Battelle is one of the top experts on this, and The Search is a fantastic book. Danny, do you have a source or a book that you ever recommend to people if they want to get up on search, besides reading Search Engine Land, of course?
Sure. John's is an excellent book on the origins, not just of Google, but the whole search space period. You know, one of the best things he did in that book is he didn't just completely focus on Google. He talked about GoTo, which was Overture, which was the ads type of thing as well. I would really recommend beyond that, Ken Auletta's Googled, which came out last year. And in some ways, it picks up where John's book left off, because when John's book ended, you know, Google had turned into this big, huge thing. And Ken's book looks at, you know, how Google has kind of evolved over that and coped with going into these new areas and how they've been very disruptive. And in being disruptive, they've gained a number of people who kind of hate them out down the way. So those are two excellent books, well worth looking at.
Ken Auletta, A-U-L-E-T-T-A, is the author of Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. So you can, under the Platinum plan here, you could try both of those out. Or you could get the first two books in the Dark Tower series. Either one. Try it out. Go to audible.com/twit2. That's twit and the number two. And we thank Audible for their support. Google actually had another announcement this week that had nothing to do with search, had to do with Android. Honeycomb was unveiled in a big press event, which, frankly, I felt like it was a little overdoing it, but it was very developer-focused, and I think that was the point, was to say, hey, folks, if you want to start developing your apps for a tablet, start doing it on Android, because this is what Honeycomb is going to be capable of. Harry, did you attend the event?
I was there, and, you know, there was not a lot in the way of new news. A lot of it was recapping stuff we already knew about. And I almost think that's good, because whenever I write about Android, I say, Google, you should stop adding new features to Android until you really focus on the user interface and get it at least a little bit closer to what Apple does. And from what I can tell with Honeycomb, I mean, the primary focus has been building a good user interface for a tablet. And, well, I want to get more hands-on time with one. What I've seen so far looks quite good.
They used the Motorola Zoom to show off Honeycomb, which was an announcement in itself that the Zoom could actually do something besides play a video of what Honeycomb would look like someday.
Well, that was one of the funny things at CES was talking, you know, to people from Toshiba and Dell and other places. And everybody was like, yeah, Android 3.0, Honeycomb. The only people who have access to it is Motorola. So we'll see how the new operating system I'm building my hardware for runs when I get to see Android 3.0, which I thought was actually kind of bizarre that Motorola had completely locked down access to this coming in through CES. And listening to people talking on the show floor about the fact that we don't have access to Android, we don't have access to Honeycomb, and we're looking forward to seeing Honeycomb. And boy, wouldn't it be nice to start working on apps for Honeycomb? It just seemed very strange that they were restricting access to this to a single developer for so long, or a single hardware manufacturer for so long.
I was convinced that we weren't going to see the Motorola Zoom, because usually at CES, when something is that locked down and that controlled, it's vapor hardware. It's something you don't end up seeing for a year or more. But they were
working at last week, although I noticed one developer was showing me an app which uses Flash, but his Zoom did not have Flash on it, so he really couldn't show off his app. And I also saw one of the demo machines.
Ouch.
Need to be rebooted. So
now wait a minute. I thought Zoom was supposed to have Flash. I thought that was one of its advantages.
It will, but for whatever reason, the unit he was trying to demo his Flash-enabled app on did not have Flash on it yet. So my sense is there's still quite a bit of work left to be done in a relatively short amount of time.
Is the Zoom going to sell well? Any bets on how much of a chunk of the of the marketplace that'll take?
I don't think we know what the price is yet, do we?
There's been rumors, but no, we don't have an official price from it, as far as I know. The rumors are $700 or $800, depending on whether it's Wi-Fi only or not.
Which sounds really high, and I think the price is going to be a huge factor.
Will you get one, Danny?
I probably will, just because it'll be interesting to have, you know, for work reasons, a Google-based tablet. Mm-hmm. The Galaxy one is interesting. When the Galaxy came out, with whatever the Galaxy Tabs, it didn't feel as compelled. But Honeycomb seems like a... of writing it as a business expense. I think that'll be one of the things key, too, is that, you know, do I get a Wi-Fi-only version? Will that be much less and closer to the iPad price if you're going Wi-Fi or not? But from what I've seen of Honeycomb, it sure looks nice. you know, I'm really intrigued to try it with a head-to-head against the iPad.
There's a Motorola Zoom ad in the Super Bowl today that takes a little bit of a hit on Apple. They show a lot of people with white earbuds in their ears walking around in looking identically dressed in white coats. But what's funny is they're spending a lot of money on a Super Bowl ad for a product that doesn't have a release date or a price yet.
Well, the rumor is that it's going to come out at the end of February, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
That is the... It's all rumor at this point.
Perhaps we'll find out during the Super Bowl tonight.
Yeah, maybe they'll... Yeah. Maybe you'll know by the time you listen to this podcast later this week. Who knows? All right, let's move along to another tablet item, but this one on the iPad. Rupert Murdoch's attempt to bring publishing direct to the tablet with The Daily. The Daily has its own staff dedicated to writing The Daily, so it's not a print publication that's being adapted. In fact, they have a website, but they're not even publishing to the website. It's very limited what you get when you go to the website. The idea is that you will buy The Daily and you will use it as your newspaper. But it's only updated once a day, maybe with breaking news updated a couple of other times a day. Has anybody read it, first of all? I mean, I'm sure most of you have had a chance to at least take a peek at it.
I've only read it online. There are kind of hacks, or if you know where to look, you can get to the daily content. There's actually a Tumblr blog
that, oh, yeah, I saw
takes,
that.
Takes everything and puts it there. And
right, because you can send a link to someone from within the app, which allows them to read the story, even if it's not linked directly from their website. So somebody just sent emails to themselves of all of the articles, and boom, there was a website with all the articles. Although not everything is there, but 90% of it.
But what, you know, when I've looked at the stories, there's been nothing that kind of made me go, ooh, this is really compelling for me to get. But, you know, I got to try it out on the iPad and actually see if it goes. But... You know, if I've got my iPad, I usually kind of want to know what's the latest story. And this idea that it's not going to be updated on a regular basis, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Patrick, is this something you see as good long-form journalism? It can save the print world?
Well, it's not saving the print world. It's not print. I started out working in newspapers. My favorite thing of all time, I think, in some ways, was working on magazines. I'm fascinated by this as somebody who reads a lot of magazines and still gets the daily newspaper. But it's bizarre. I mean, they're doing a $3 million something in the middle of the halftime show at the Super Bowl, whether it's an advertisement
Super Bowl is carried on Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch this year. So handy for The Daily.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I've heard, you know, they've spent, you know, $30 million, $300 million, you know, ridiculous numbers are being tossed around. They're talking about 100 pages, 365 days a year. And, you know, I can almost hear Harry at the other side of Skype going, oh, dear God, you know, how many people is it going to take to do that? Even if 25, 30 pages of it is weather and sports scores and Sudoku and crossword puzzles, where it's essentially, you know, auto-generated content that requires very little manipulation, they're still talking about filling a huge amount of content. It's cheap, $40 for a year, so they've got that side of it on. But I just, you know, Murdoch didn't do really great with MySpace. You know, I'm waiting for this to sort of grab me and get me all excited, and it just hasn't happened yet.
Harry, I've seen some estimates saying that it's going to take 400,000 paying subscribers to make The Daily break even.
I think Rupert Murdoch is saying they're spending like $500,000 a week.
Yeah,
to make it happen, they went out and they hired a bunch of talented journalists, which is not cheap. The thing that confuses me most is most of the other large media companies that have hired a lot of talented people are trying to get that content out on as many platforms as possible. You know, they're doing tablet apps. They're on the web. They're doing mobile stuff. Some of them are doing print. The Daily is sort of entirely putting all of its chips on one platform. And, well, the content I read is quite good. There's a lot of quite good newspaper-style content out there, and most of it's available in more places. And at least right now, most of it's available for free.
when you consider that the New York Times sells 800,000 copies of its print newspaper, and we've got to, he's got to get, Rupert Murdoch's got to get 420,000 subscribers, so a little over half of that on an iPad app. Now, there's a lot of people with iPads, but there's a lot more people, there's a lot more people with front porches.
Well, he's charging a lot less than the Times does for print. Right.
So, sure.
It's like $1 a week, so it's less than one copy.
$40 a year.
Of the Times.
Patrick, you think it's equivalent? You think they can do it?
Well, I think the bet here is that, wow, they sold 10 million iPads. You know, they haven't even gotten to the second version of the iPad yet. So they're, you know, do I think they can do it? You know, I think anything can happen. I mean, look at the, you know, an eighth grader and his mom managed to, at least for a short period of time, you know, rise above Angry Birds in the free games ranking.
Right,
so
right.
Anything is possible. I'm just really curious if it's sustainable, because filling 100 pages every day, that they're essentially creating the sort of newsroom that every newspaper in the country, if not the world, has been hacking down at for the last 5-10 years. And they're trying to do that for an online publication. You know, it's the closest thing I can think of. It is the launch of oh my goodness, the McPaper, the national paper, the
USA Today.
Yeah. Right. Which is like, you know, the New York Times is fundamentally a very narrow, it has a very narrow and defined audience, you know, for being, having as much weight as it does. So looking at the Daily, it's going to have to be very generic, very broad, to get those kind of numbers. I mean, Murdoch certainly knows how to do that. I'm a little mind blown that he's starting something this big and this expensive.
Pretty, you know? Ballsy, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. He obviously believes in the iPad as a platform, but it's just kind of a really surprising thing for somebody to be doing in this day and age, especially because, as Henry points out, good journalists are not inexpensive. Good journalism is not inexpensive to maintain, and there are so many sources of good writing on the web for absolutely free. And what Murdoch is betting is he can create this, you know, experience around the iPad and tailoring an application for the iPad that'll make it better than reading text on a page. And, you know, that's an interesting guess.
And this is very glossy. I mean, they've got sort of a cover flow like right. situation going on. It does some things that really well. It shows you, you know, like what is your weather, you know, in your local area automatically. And it shows you your local sports teams based on your, you know, and it brings in Twitter streams. So you get a little bit of up-to-date stuff. But it's a daily magazine. And I think that's what really has confused me at the beginning, which is this isn't a daily newspaper. And 'cause that was my first criticism is, well, why hasn't it got the top stories of the day? Why, when I open up the first one, was right. it telling me last night's news about Egypt when lots of stuff has happened since then? And a lot of people pointed out, well, wait a minute, you know, this has got some really high quality long form pieces in it. And there's a market for that. And there's a need for that. So it's not valueless. And I definitely agree with that. But it wasn't what I wanted. It's not what I expected. And I think that's my question is there a marketplace for people who have tablets? Because it will get off the iPad eventually. It'll be available for Android. Is there a market for people who have tablets who want to read sort of a lean back daily New Yorker, Atlantic, The Nation sort of experience where it's like, this isn't keeping me up to date. This is informing me in a more laid back fashion.
Well, I think there's a market for people who want to read long form journalism. I just don't think that long form journalism all comes from one place. And the challenge right now really seems to be creating a way for them to keep up on the stuff from a variety of sources, which would be the opposite of what Murdoch really wants. Murdoch wants the Daily to be the place you're always going to get your stuff and you're always coming there. And really things like, I think, Instapaper or a few other apps that are pulling in and allowing you to save and allowing you to read things, especially if they allow you to find stuff on your phone or on your desktop and they keep it all in sync. That's ideal. That you know, that way you can sit down and say, right, I want to look at this sort of thing. Maybe I want to see some of the breaking headlines along with it. But that's all aggregation. And to Murdoch, aggregation is a sin that's going to cost him money. That's just giving away stuff for people for free. the reality is aggregation doesn't mean that you have to give away stuff for free. Maybe you come up with a way to work with the aggregator so you're paying for some of the content, or you know, they're getting subscriptions because they know that some of the stuff they want is from the Daily. But right now, the Daily is a walled garden that has no presence. You know, I was having fun doing some searches on Google trying to see what I could find or any of these stories. There was one nice story about, you know, the impact on Jamaica of tourism and, you know, how it reshapes the island and in bad ways. Good content that you're not going to locate very easily. Some of the articles are just completely images, so they're not going to be, you know, findable. And they may be, you know, so far they're not blocked from Google. But I just... I don't know that the solution is the complete walled garden. I don't know that the solution is you just give it all away either. But, you know, we'll see here's how his grand experiment goes, I suppose.
Yeah. And you know what? I'll give him that. It is a grand experiment. And it is an interesting effort to use a medium to its best advantage, and that is shown in the sort of that cover flow aspect and the 360 degree photos and everything. I don't see anything revolutionary. They're taking bits and pieces of things that have been done before, but they are putting them together in a very attractive way.
It'll be fascinating to see just how patient they are. I mean, will this be around a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now? If they're not rolling in profits quickly, yeah, which they probably won't be.
All right. It's going to be all Verizon iPhone news next week, I have a feeling. The Verizon iPhone will be coming out on Thursday. You'll be able to pre-order on Wednesday if you're not a Verizon subscriber. We'll talk a little more about that and the iPhone wars that are heating up in a minute. But we actually have a message from Leo Laporte, who is probably on a ship eating caviar and drinking champagne. But he was nice enough to leave us this message to thank another one of our sponsors.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guys. Sorry to bother you, interrupt you. We'll be getting right back to the Twit conversation in just a bit, but I thought I'd stop by, interrupt, and tell you all about one of my favorite remote access products. Now, you know I'm away. I'm in South America right now. I actually recorded this ahead of time, but I'll tell you what I did bring with me as I went to South America. Go to my PC. See, we've got many of the computers here, and certainly my computers at home are all set up with GoToMyPC, so I can get to them from anywhere, even shipboard, even Tierra del Fuego. As long as I can get online, I can get to my computer. It's so amazing. And boy, talk about telecommuting. You can skip the rush hour, save time, money, and frustration, work from home with GoToMyPC. I used to actually commute every day for 2 or 3 hours a day, and it drove me crazy. Now I look at the traffic report on the news, and I go, I don't do that. A lot of people I know get stuck in it in and around San Francisco or L.A., Chicago, D.C., Atlanta, just about every major city these days. It's so funny. You go to a city, and they say, yeah, we have the worst traffic. It's almost as if they're bragging. No, the traffic's worse here. I've heard that in New York. I've heard it in Atlanta. I've heard it in D.C. Certainly, I believe it in L.A. All that time in traffic costs you time. Of course, I think the average commute is going up and up and up, and I think it's now almost 45 minutes a day. I was 3 hours. I was twice that, four times that. Of course, the money and the miles on your car and the gas and all that, and the stress, the energy, the loss of peace of mind, if you will. For everyone who gets stuck in traffic, two words to consider: stay home. Telecommuting, it's the hot thing, and you can do that with GoToMyPC. GoToMyPC lets you access your office computer from anywhere you can get online. Do anything you would do at work. Use any program, access any file, even network files. You could check email, run programs. It's just like you're there. It's fast. It's secure. 128-bit SSL. And there has never been a remote access exploit with GoToMyPC. Can't say that for the other guys. It's an award-winning remote access service from Citrix. You don't even need any extra hardware. You just need GoToMyPC. Get it free right now by visiting gotomypc.com/twit. GOTOMYPC.com/twit. You can do it while you're listening to the show. Really, seriously. It takes very little time and bandwidth, and then you're ready. Just do it now for 30 days. That way you'll be ready for the next time you don't want to go to work. You don't want to sit in traffic. You are on a vacation or a trip. Go to mypc.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support. Now, my friends, back to the twits. Tom?
Thank you, Leo. He just wanted to show off that he can do that from a boat. Not just that, but the go to my PC as well. He can be in our computers right now. All right, have you seen the latest iPhone commercials, y'all? They're the Verizon's rolled out their personal computer. There's been one from Apple that showed the phones side by side and how, like, you know, it's peace and love for everyone. But we've got one now from Verizon, which definitely is a very exciting, you know, we've made the iPhone part of our family thing. But it does take a little plug at AT&T, and I think we're going to see an internecine iPhone conflict here. We're loading it up right now. We'll play it for you. But nobody's seen it yet?
No.
I've not.
All right. Well, here's your chance. Well, maybe it'll be your chance. Essentially, it's just a lot of dramatic shots of the iPhone with dramatic music playing. And then at the end, it's the Verizon guy. I can hear you now. Because it's their tagline. And also a little dig at AT&T. AT&T has come back at them, though, with a commercial of their own touting the fact that on an AT&T iPhone, you can surf the web and talk at the same time. That's their big comeback against Verizon for anything. Motorola wants in, too, as we mentioned. They're going to be taking a dig at Apple in the Super Bowl ad. It's sort of a send-up of the 1984 thing. Verizon is going to also prepare their network for the onslaught. Because, you know, the joke is, the thing about the iPhone on Verizon is it now makes calls. Because AT&T is so poor in some parts of the country. But Verizon says they are going to throttle the data speeds of the 5% of their heaviest users for the rest of a billing cycle and the next billing cycle. Is that fair? Is that, I mean, Verizon supposedly can handle all this, but it seems to be in advance of the iPhone coming that they want to make sure that they can handle all of these bandwidth hogs that are going to come along. Patrick, go ahead, Danny.
Well, it's funny. I was on Verizon for the longest time, then went to the iPhone. Now the only thing I have with Verizon is my broadband card. But I keep hearing all these things that they seem that they're going to do special for the iPhone people that are going to be coming in, where we get apparently unlimited plans. But if you're not on an iPhone, you won't get an unlimited plan. You know, just pick a policy and go with it. If you want to throttle the heavy usage from, you know, certain users, then do that, but do it consistently. And all this stuff that they're doing just ahead of the iPhone, it just, I don't know. It doesn't leave a good taste in your mouth, I suppose, in the end.
I think, I don't know, it seems like they're trying to do a lot to be considered as extremely proactive and ready for the iPhone, because they know a lot of people that will leave AT&T for Verizon, and rumors are floating around whether or not Verizon will offer, you know, on corporate accounts, they've mentioned that they're going to be offering compensation for kill fees for leaving AT&T to go to Verizon. Whether or not they're going to do that on a consumer level, nobody really knows. But they're talking about basically dealing with the top 5%. You know, what is it? If you use an extraordinary amount of data and fall within the top 5% of Verizon wireless data users, we may reduce your data throughput speeds periodically for the remainder of your then current and immediately following billing. Well, current and immediately following billing cycle to ensure high quality network performance. Basically, you know, our proactive management is designed to ensure that the remaining 95% of data customers aren't negatively affected by the inordinate data consumption of just a few users. And 5% a big old chunk of users. You know, they're also basically talking about automatically de-resing video. I'm sorry, not reducing resolution, implementing optimization and transcoding technologies in our network to transmit data files in a more efficient manner. And it's like, okay, so they're packet shaping and they're going to detect video and they're going to optimize it. I'm going to put optimize in brackets, you know, for your device. I think it's going to be really interesting. I think Verizon's panicking, panicking is probably not the right word. I think Verizon's nervous that if they blow the transition, and they're saying like a relatively small number of units, 100,000 or so handsets are going to come out for the initial rollout on Verizon. And I think they want to make sure things are as stable as possible, especially because they also have a lot of Android devices coming out, you know, and sort of dogpiling on more data. I think it's going to be really, you know, really interesting, you know, especially when you're saying things like, while we invest much effort to avoid changing text, image, and video files in the compression process, and while any change to the file is likely to be indiscernible, the optimization process may minimally impact the appearance of the file. So I think they're, you know, I think they're afraid that they're going to have the same problem AT&T did, which is to just have their network absolutely slammed in the wake of people, you know, buying iPhones in large volumes.
Now, the pre-orders for existing Verizon customers happened this past week, and by 8 o'clock that night, they stopped taking them. They said, we're sold out.
Right.
And it's they won't say how many they actually sold. Mike Abramsky of RBC estimates it was less than 100,000, but Verizon's trying to imply it's the biggest selling smartphone that they've ever had. And they, you know, over the first weekend of the Droid, they sold 100,000. But this was just pre-orders for existing Verizon customers. Starting on this coming Thursday, if you're a non-Verizon customer, you can reserve or pre-order your iPhone and either go pick it up in a store on I guess you'll start the pre-order on Wednesday and then pick it up in the store on Thursday. And I think it's going to be a zoo. We're actually going to be out there covered. We're going to find out. We're sending Sarah Lane, poor thing, at 6:45 a.m. Pacific time on Thursday morning to stand in front of the San Francisco flagship store. Do you think she'll be alone? Anybody
in San Francisco?
Yeah.
No, I know a lot of people with iPhones, and the only ones I've heard that are immediately like, I'm dumping my iPhone on AT&T to go to Verizon are all San Francisco residents, obviously, because
or New Yorkers. You know,
I haven't heard from any New Yorkers yet, but I wouldn't be surprised. Like, you know, and it's going to be really funny to see whether or not the sort of density of, you know, whether it's AT&T's network or whether it's the incredible density of iPhone users in that area that creates the problem.
I think it's going to be huge. I think the fact that the pre-orders sold so quickly means we're going to see a lot of people not on Verizon yet switching over to Verizon. But Harry, do you think it can hold up under the strain?
We'll see. I mean, I think they may be more worried about the first few days than they are about the long term, just because it's like Disneyland opening up the gates and people flooding in. And once they're a little more fully dispersed, they're okay. I do wish they were more straightforward about this stuff, and it's just hard to know. And I do feel a little bit for 5%, because like Patrick says, 5% of Verizon's entire user base is not an insignificant number of people. And when you sold me this service and you said you didn't give me a limit on how I could use it, it seems a little shabby to then be saying that I'm using an inordinately large amount or misbehaving.
Yeah, I paid for that data. Why suddenly, because I happen to be making good use of it, can I not use it anymore?
Yeah, I think just tell me how much I'm going to get.
Yeah, I think they're extremely uptight about tethering and how much that might be abused by end users. Because it's like you can blow through a data, you know, you download 3 or 4 videos off of iTunes, like HD resolution videos, or purchase 3 or 4 videos on iTunes, and you can blow through the data cap on almost any wireless service right now, at least 3G wireless services like Sprint on the 4G. They're not counting your bandwidth at this point if you can actually get 4G. So I think they're super panicked about, you know, like Harry said, the initial rollout. I think they're kind of nervous. They want to sort of tone people down and how vicious they get with using the tethering with their notebooks. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens and how the initial Verizon customers react and whether or not we come back to the classic, like, you know, if you ask, like, you know, you get 1,000, you know, Texilla viewers or 1,000, you know, Twit viewers in a room, and it's like, okay, who thinks Sprint sucks, and like a third of the hands go up, and who thinks Verizon sucks, and a third of the hand goes up, and who thinks T-Mobile sucks, and maybe like 8 hands go up. But you know,
T-Mobile was just rated by JD Power as having the best customer satisfaction.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are super happy with T-Mobile. I also know a lot of people that can't get the devices they want on T-Mobile, not as much now as in the past, but you know, you're also talking about a smaller group of customers by comparison. So, you know, I think it's going to be, you know, no matter how well Verizon is prepared for this, I think it's going to be an ugly week. I think it'll be interesting to see when people start running into the data caps, if they do. Because the thing that always comes out from Sprint or AT&T and anybody else, it's like the biggest data consumption is always like 3% of the customers. It's just, you know, and 3% of the customers are trying to download like every video on the planet simultaneously, and they blow through the caps. But, you know, when they say ruining it for everybody, it makes me wonder if their switches are really prepared, their towers are really prepared for the level of data traffic they expect off the new iPhone population.
Yeah, I think that's probably why they put in place this policy. And if you read it carefully, they say we may throttle you if you're in the top 5% at times. So they're not going to just throttle you down and then you're stuck on the slow lane for the rest of the month and the next month. What they're saying is, you know, once you're in that top 5%, if we start having these problems, we may ratchet you down. It's in their best interest to only do it when they absolutely have to, because the first person it happens to is going to go blog about it and put it on Twitter immediately. Let's move on to Nokia Microsoft rumors. This started last Monday when Adnan Ahmad of Berenberg Bank in Hamburg, he's an analyst, said Nokia should partner up with Microsoft. It almost feels like a shill at this point, because all week long the stock rose. Everyone talked about what a great idea it was. Stephen Elop is now the CEO of Nokia. He's from Microsoft. He came over from Microsoft. But there are some folks saying, no, this is not going to happen. There's not going to be a partnership between Nokia and Microsoft. Mary Jo Foley of ZDNet doesn't think so. Chris Ziegler over at Engadget says he's got sources that say, yeah, it is going to happen. But we don't know what form it would take. Most of the speculation is Nokia would put out phones with Windows Phone 7 on them. Are we going to see that, Harry? Are we going to see Nokia expanding the number of operating systems on its phones?
Well, and they basically have to use some operating system they're not currently using, because I don't think it's going to cut it unless they use one of the big OSs. And then the other obvious choice would be Android. But I have no idea whether Windows Phone 7 will show up on Nokia handsets, but I don't see why they shouldn't try it. I mean, it would obviously be great news for Microsoft, not so much in the U.S. because Nokia is not a big player here, but in the rest of the world, it would clearly be a good thing for Windows Phone 7, and it might give Nokia something that was a little more exciting than the Symbian-based handsets.
But Nokia is known for the integration of their operating system with their device. If they go to starting doing third parties like Android or Windows Phone 7, then suddenly they're just another HTC or something like that. And that's, I think, for them, a harder marketplace to compete in.
That's true. But unless they pull something amazing out of their hat, like in the next 90 days, they've got to do something other than the strategy that got them to be a big player in the first place. And they don't have to bet the entire company on Windows Phone 7 for it to be worth trying either. They could just do a handset or two and try to make it good.
It's going to be the marriage of two declining platforms in any case. I mean, a lot of people have looked at this and said, it doesn't matter if Nokia puts Windows Phone 7 on their phones or not. Nobody's uptaking Windows Phone 7 right now. There's a whole spat last week over this weird data leak that people with Windows Phone 7 have been having because of the way Yahoo Mail checks its mail. It downloads a lot more data than it needs just to see if there is a piece of mail there. Microsoft's been very slow to admit there was a problem, admit who the problem was, until researcher Rafael Rivera finally admitted it. I talked to Paul Thurrott on Windows Weekly about it this week, and he has a whole explanation of what happened. But the upshot is Microsoft still hasn't updated Windows Phone 7. It just seems like they're moving very slowly, and this phone's operating system, which is a very nice operating system, is not getting any uptake.
Do they have to be? They don't have to be Windows 7 specific, though. They could go Windows 7. They could run Android as well. They could be an HTC, basically. They could continue to put out phones with their own operating system too, and basically play all the cards, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's a question that if they did partner with Microsoft on Windows Phone 7, Microsoft might actually contribute a little bit to MeeGo or Symbian to help spruce that operating system up. You're right. They wouldn't have to choose sides. Is that a good thing, though? I mean, would that work for them? I guess they're grasping at straws right now because they just lost the lead in smartphones. They're still the number one overall phone maker, but
If you take the HTC example, I don't know where their finances are or anything, but they seem to be doing just fine, and they seem to be doing fine, you know, being friends with everybody. They just make the handsets. So you want an Android phone, you get it on HTC, and you can get it on any carrier. If you want a, if you want a Windows 7 phone, they're doing that as well. Nokia's got a great brand. I don't know that people – I think they still do have a great brand. I don't know that people necessarily think that that brand has to translate into the actual Nokia operating system for mobile being on a Nokia handset. They just might think, it's a Nokia, and just be happy to have whatever operating system is on it. So,
well, and then the question is, is Nokia's hardware good enough to compete?
They still make some really nice hardware. I mean, they made a number of phones over the last few years where the software is woefully – obsolete, but the device itself has a really nice camera and respectable industrial design. And the one thing that's lacking is that you don't really want to use the interface.
All right, we got a few more stories to get to. Canada is fighting a bandwidth cap rule from their version of the FCC, the CRTC. Viacom is back on Hulu. We've run out of IPv4 addresses. We'll get to that and more as we wrap up. But I want to thank our final sponsor for today's show, Squarespace. At squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. You can say it along with us. You've heard us talk about it before, but Squarespace makes beautiful websites. If you have a blog, if you have a podcast, and you want an easy way to make it look good because maybe you're design dumb like I am, and you just, you know what? I want a template that I can make a few easy modifications to make it look my own, but I don't want to have to draw anything or come up with a design or figure out the layout. That's what Squarespace is perfect for. You go in, you sign up. It's optimized for beginners. If you are a CSS expert and you do want position control of everything on the page, you can do that too. You can go in and tweak the CSS code and get the best of both worlds. Use the template to get you going and then modify it to your heart's content. Hundreds of design templates. You can build out all the modules you want. You want to include your Flickr stream in there. You can do it and make it look good. And if you've already got a blog and you're like, well, I don't want to lose all my old posts, they have an import module for WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, and Typepad. So you can bring your stuff in and you're not locked in. If you decide you want to leave Squarespace, they support data portability. So your data is still yours if you use Squarespace. And the best part is if you get really popular, which, I mean, that's what you want, right? You want to get really popular. Your website won't go down just because a lot of people decided to visit it at once. They will provision you bandwidth with the popularity of your site. You still pay the same amount for hosting. So why don't you try it for free? Go start a website. See how good-looking website you can make on Squarespace. 14-day free trial for Twit users at squarespace.com/twit to give it a shot. Try building out a website. You could even import your old website into your old blog into Squarespace during the trial and see how it works for you. Sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card to try it out. There's no reason not to. Go to squarespace.com/twit and give it a shot. If you want to see some examples, go to swordandlaser.com. That's the podcast I do with Veronica Belmont, co-host of Techzilla with Patrick Norton. And we use Squarespace for that. That's one example of the many. We thank Squarespace for their support. How many did you guys hear about the CRTC bandwidth cap situation this week? It sort of cropped up and then simmered back down all within a week. The CRTC is the FCC of Canada, and Mr. Conrad von Finkenstein is the head of the CRTC. What they did is they put a decision in place that said there are caps on Bell's offerings to people. So if you sign up for Bell, you get 25 gigabytes a month, very small, on your monthly account. And then if you want to buy insurance against going over that cap, you can buy it in like couple dollar, you just throw down an extra toonie a month in Canada, and you get a little, you get 5 more gigabytes, 10 more gigabytes. They also have something called a vault, where you can buy gigabytes against going over a cap without having to pay the monthly insurance. So if you go over your 25 gigabytes in a month, it takes it out of the vault. You don't get charged the overage fee. You don't get throttled down. What the CRTC said is, Bell, we require you to open your pipes and sell your service to third-party competitors. And we're going to allow you to force the third-party competitors to abide by your bandwidth caps, which meant that all the third-party sellers, all the competition, now had to offer pretty much exactly the same service that you get from Bell, and in most cases, charge a little more for it. It limited their competitiveness. Now, this didn't affect every single Canadian. You could get your service from Cable, Rogers, and Shaw, but they had their own bandwidth caps, usually higher. There was a huge outcry, a huge petition. Stephen Harper, the prime minister, actually said, CRTC, you need to overturn this or we will overturn it for you in Parliament. And von Finkenstein has said they will take the next 60 days to review this and decide what to do when they're going to take public comment. But they're not going to implement it right away. So you don't have to have that bandwidth cap if you're on a third party. You can go unlimited. But in 60 days, they'll decide whether they're actually going to allow it to be implemented or not. Now, obviously, none of us are in Canada, so this doesn't affect us here. But which of you could get by on 25 gigabytes a month?
Ha!
I honestly don't have a clue. I couldn't tell you how much I use. I mean, this all reminds me a little bit of using CompuServe in about 1991, when I was keenly aware of how much CompuServe I use because I was paying by the hour. I do know I have a Verizon MiFi card for wireless broadband. And that I keep tabs on because I have a 5 gigabyte limit. And I basically use that all I want for wireless stuff. And I really never even approach going over the limit. But on the other hand, I'm not doing all the stuff I do at home where I'm streaming all the video I want and downloading all the files I want. So I would love to try metering myself for a while just as a reality check to see where I am in relation to 25 gigabytes.
It can be really, especially if you use Netflix or iTunes video in any kind of volume, a 25 gigabyte cap would be absolutely brutal. I think we'd blow through that in my house in about a week and a half.
It sounds painful with the insurance and it sounds like a Las Vegas game or something with all the betting about what you're going to do.
Yeah, right. It's like you're playing blackjack with your gigabytes.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's like, because it's like one of those semi-slimy kind of like, hey, we're going to make sure we don't charge you over by charging you monthly, whether or not you ever go over or not. So if you're paranoid and you're conservative, like many Canadians are, I shouldn't say paranoid, but most Canadians, you think Canada, you think people are like trying to do the right thing. You think stereotypes, you think foolish thoughts, but I can also already, probably in the chat room right now, everybody from Australia is going, oh, it sucks. It really sucks. We've always had these kind of caps. They suck. Fight, Canada, fight. It's just atrocious. And it's a bizarre regulation to hand down. You know, we're going to make everybody's service suck as bad as the people who built the network service. It's like, why? That reeks of the kind of thing a lobbyist would put in. For example, like Verizon and AT&T spending $11 million lobbying in Washington, D.C. And miraculously, mobile internet doesn't get regulated in our pseudo net neutrality regulations passed by the FCC.
80 gigabytes a month under this new plan would cost you $41.45. I'm sorry, this is 105 gigabytes would cost you $41.45. Previously, the 200 gigabyte cap was what they had, as well as unlimited. 200 gigabyte cap was $32 a month. So you get half the gigabytes you were getting under the old plan, but you get to pay $10 more.
It's a lot like AT&T when people started downloading video in volume, and AT&T had their technical economists or economist engineers, had this really bizarre title for them, basically write these really long white papers about, yes, we think we sold you this amount of bandwidth, but we only sold you that bandwidth speed for a few seconds at a time as you downloaded some web pages. We never, ever meant for you to actually use all of the bandwidth you think you're already paying for us on a monthly basis. So I think it's interesting. There's obviously, you know, huge interest in the United States over net neutrality, whether you're pro or con. I hear a lot of noise that a lot of the major ISPs are all trying to figure out how they can implement tiered or per bit pricing, whether or not they need to or whether or not they want to, because it'll look good on Wall Street is kind of the real question, because the white papers by the technical economists were an absolute joke,
it's this kind of false idea that there's only so many bits that we can deliver. That's not really the way the internet works. It's not like the water company says, look, we've only got so much water. We have to conserve because it's not raining. You know, I mean, it's the bandwidth argument is so obfuscated by this oversimplification of like, but if we don't limit it to 25 gigabytes, we'll run out of bits. It's not the way it works.
If we don't limit it to 25 gigabytes, we'll have to upgrade our infrastructure and actually deliver on what customers think they have already purchased.
And that's where the debate is, right? Which is how much is that infrastructure and what is the incremental cost and what do you get? It's not like the company, the telco can only deliver, you know, say 500,000 gigabytes a month. And if they spend another $1 million, it'll be 600,000 gigabytes a month. I mean, it's all about provisioning at the head end in ways that allow bandwidth to get routed correctly. Everybody can get unlimited bandwidth. That doesn't mean that you'll have quality of service all the time. It comes and goes. But as I understand it, I'm getting out of my depth here, but you want to over-provision in order to avoid lag. And I think these telcos are exploiting that in order to make a bunch of money off something that actually doesn't fix that problem. They just want to charge you more. We need a network engineer now.
Well, we also should own up that we make our living on video and obviously unfettered access to bits.
Not just for us, right?
I feed my son hurling a lot and lot and lots and lots and lots of bits onto the internet. So,
for instance, they do not have Hulu in Canada. Not because of the bandwidth problem, but it could discourage innovation in these areas. It could discourage companies like Twit and Revision 3 from actually getting started and trying things if the telcos were able to put such a vice-like grip on the data. Absolutely. I have a vested interest in this, believe me, but I can always go back to slinging books if I have to. Viacom is back on Hulu. The Daily Show is there. Colbert Report is there. And some of their other shows will show up 21 days after their first airing. Apparently, Viacom's paying $40 million. But the bigger part of this story was CEO Jason Kilar going off on his blog when he announced this about how behind the television industry is. And a lot of people feel like he was shooting himself in the foot. He might be trying to get fired. A lot of people say, no, he's not. That's just the way he is. He believes in this medium and that the internet is going to win. And, you know, he's right. Did you guys see much about this, Harry? Did you follow the story?
I saw that. I mean, there's also talk about Hulu maybe essentially having to go to an entirely different business model where it's a little bit more like Netflix and a little more controlled by the TV industry. I mean, Hulu is a fabulous product. It's wildly popular, and it's not clear whether the people who own the content are going to allow it to continue in the way it has. And I think that that Kilar, the CEO, is kind of in between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, his masters are the old media who really started this website in a fit against YouTube.
And yeah, now they opened Pandora's box and now they want to try to shut it again.
Yeah. Now they don't know what to do with it.
The crazy thing is, you know, like for me, Hulu has become my DVR. And it's, if I were an advertiser, awesome, because unlike with my actual DVR, I can't skip through the ads. You have to watch them. So I sit there and I watch them simply because I've got no choice. And yet the ad pricing, I think, on Hulu, they either can't sell or they're still selling it underpriced what they're doing on the broadcast, which is continuing to die. And you just watch these industries, and it's almost laughable where they just can't transition over, and you just know because of all the vested interests that they can't say, all right, we need to start selling the online stuff for more. We need to dive in more or the online. Let's just hold off as long as we can and try to milk the broadcast for as much money as we think we can get out of it.
You're exactly right, Danny. In fact, some of the off-the-record responses to Kalar were like, oh, yeah, 80% of us know he's right, but you can't say that. It's just, you know, we'll get fired.
Yeah, and we should also
get fired anyway.
And some people, there was at least one blogger or columnist who was saying that the whole point of this blog entry was his attempt to get fired so he can move into sort of a startup or something. But I mean, if you know, it's not like NBC and CBS and ABC aren't making money, and they also are still the best in the world. If you want 15 million people to show up simultaneously, they still do a better job of that than anybody else. So for the 5 or 6 advertisers that spend 25 to 40% of the money on advertising in a given year, the biggest companies, the biggest advertising spenders, like literally like 30 or 40% of all advertising is purchased probably by less than 10 companies every year, and they're not really looking for onesie twosie, purchases. They're looking for huge numbers of eyeballs. NBC, ABC, CBS, they still make a huge amount of money off of those advertisers and a lot of other advertisers. So, it's just a mess because it's the thing going back to Rupert Murdoch, I don't want to trade analog dollars for digital cents. And Hulu's obviously caught between a rock and a hard place. And I think it's going to be really interesting watching Hulu and Netflix over the next year or two, because all of the studios are kind of like, we've got to rein in Netflix. And, it's ridiculous that Starz did the deal with Netflix because, Netflix pays so much of their content comes from their Starz deal. They are restricted from doing HD, but they do standard definition content. They get a huge number of titles literally for like 3 or 6 cents a head versus your local cable company who would pay like $2 or $3 a head for that exact same content. So I think the deals between the studios and the networks and the online vendors like Netflix and Hulu, I think that's going to get really messy and really nasty over the next year or two.
And that's what one of the things Kalar said is we've got to start paying per view per month for this stuff, which is essentially what the Viacom deal is. Viacom gets paid more the more people watch their stuff rather than these flat fees, which in Netflix's case started out as seemingly a good valuation, but Netflix grew much faster than everyone thought they would, and now it ends up being incredibly cheap.
But you also get the flip side. It's like I'm not charged, per view of what I'm watching on NBC when they broadcast it to the world for free. They want me to watch it. They want my eyeballs. And when you start getting onto the internet, it just starts becoming this completely weird thing, as if suddenly I don't count as a viewer as much, or my attention is not worthwhile, or just showing the ads isn't worthwhile enough. I need to start paying for it. I mean, I pay, over $100 a month for my satellite subscription. So I suppose down the line, maybe I will have, if you will, an online TV subscription that they could figure out a way that I'm paying it all across to. But then if I'm going to do that, then don't keep charging me what I'm paying for the broadcast stuff, which I'm basically paying for mainly because I get better reception.
No, you're paying a small subset of what the broadcast carriage for cable for DirecTV. I mean, I gave up on DirecTV. We moved the last time, and it's been interesting. There's certain programs we missed, and my wife's kind of really ticked off. Like, she's not seeing the first season of the first few episodes of Big Love, and it's funny. HBO's like, we want like $20 a month, or we want Netflix to be charging at least $20 a month. For their service, and then there's a real nasty rift in between what the broadcasters, especially somebody like ESPN, is used to paying or being paid for their content on cable or satellite versus what people are willing to pay online. And it's going to be really interesting. I think ESPN may be the one that sort of leads the way because they do a huge amount of their content on multiple platforms, but having sort of the entire HD stream available in a perfect HD set. I mean, it'll be fun to watch this battle out over the next year or two. But yeah, I think at some point Hulu, you know, the content partners or the owners really need to think of Hulu as being a legitimate thing and rather this backdoor business they can kind of, you know, hold at arm's length.
Let me tell you, as Netflix gets bigger and if Hulu gets bigger, this conversation will change materially because suddenly it'll be too big of a money pot to turn away. Right now, they can afford to make it sound like it's, you know, it's trading digital analog dollars for digital cents. But this reminds me of when I was in charge of the website at techtv.com, we were not allowed to put more than 10 minutes of video per half hour of our content on the web, or it would violate our carriage contracts with the cable companies because they were afraid that if I could watch a postage stamp size video of Tech TV shows, then no one would pay for cable anymore. Which was like, that is the least possible. They should have been going exactly the opposite, which is like, nobody's going to watch video. Let them put it on there so that they see the postage stamp and go, I really like this. I want to subscribe. I want to get this, you know, and they actually do pay for cable because they want to see it. But they did. They go the opposite way. Now, when actually you can watch full size HD video streaming, they're giving you whole shows and saying, well, but we don't want to give you whole shows all the time because that might undermine that less than 1 million viewers on Hulu might undermine our, you know, 80 to 100 million potential viewers on broadcast and cable. It doesn't make any sense. They're afraid of something that actually isn't threatening until it actually becomes threatening. And then they all jump on it and want to monetize it.
Just, yeah, I mean, it's weird because there's no question where we're going and it's going to happen pretty quickly. So, they're essentially trying to march in a direction where the industry is not going to get. And if they just look at what happened with music, I don't see why they can't figure that out and get ahead of the game rather than straggling behind.
P. Praddock 96 in the chat room just passed this along. Just posted up on Engadget by Vlad Savov. Android is ready to play February 13th at 1800 GMT. This is probably going to be a Mobile World Congress announcement. But yes, the Sony Ericsson Xperia Play, they finally stopped allowing it to just be leaked all over the place and admitted, yeah, this is what it's called. This is what it looks like. We will announce it on February 13th. Have you seen much about the Play? Mm. It's the PlayStation phone is what everyone was calling it. So it's got the buttons like you'd have on a PlayStation, but it's a slide out Android phone. And it'll exist somewhat. It'll be interesting to see the full details now that it's going to be official. It'll exist somewhat in that Sony universe. All right, we're getting close to the end of the show. We're also getting close to the end of IPv4. They passed out the last of the numbers. IPv4, if you don't know, those are the numbers behind things like domain names. So if you type in twit.tv, there's a number there. I don't remember what it is, but there's an IP address. And IPv4 has a smaller address space than IPv6. We're trying to transfer everyone over to IPv6, but that's going to cause a lot of problems because not all the routers can work that way. Almost no sites are actually delivering themselves as IPv6 sites. And we've used up all the IPv4 numbers. What are we going to do, Harry?
You know, I feel like this is one of the issues I should be worrying about more than I have. I've sort of assumed and hoped that the industry would figure it out, and I suspect they probably will.
Yeah, they had a big ceremony where they handed out the last blocks to everybody and said, all right, good luck. There is a plan on June 8th. There's going to be a IPv6 day, and big sites like Google and Facebook are all going to serve their sites as IPv6 as a way to test out what the issues might be. There's lots of IPv4 addresses that aren't being used. They're just assigned to someone right now. And so there's a lot of talk about recycling IPv4 addresses and saving some to translate so that if I'm on a machine that can only read IPv4, IPv6 could be translated into IPv4 and this and that. But it is one of those obtuse situations that, like you say, maybe we should be more worried about than we are. But the people I've talked to who actually know this stuff say they'll get it worked out. It won't be pretty, and actually there may be some bumps along the road where people won't be able to get to certain websites because the website's in IPv6 and they don't have a machine capable of translating those addresses. But
I mean, for the most part, people will. If you have Windows XP, I know you need to do a little reconfiguration. But the more modern your software is, the less likely it is it's going to be a serious issue.
All right. Any other? I got one more story I want to get to. Is there anything you guys have been dying to talk about that that we haven't covered yet, or should we just wrap this up? Patrick, you've got nothing burning a hole in your skin.
You know, the biggest thing for me over the last week was watching all the backpedaling about the internet off switch that really isn't an internet off switch. We're not like Egypt, and don't forget to reelect us next election. But I think it's a little late in the day to start getting into that one on this particular episode of Twits.
Sandy Bridge got a recall, bad chipsets, and it is causing problems. Asus, Gigabyte, Samsung, a few others have said we'll honor refunds if you bought a Sandy Bridge machine. It's not a problem with the Sandy Bridge processor. It's with a particular chipset. Right. And now Best Buy says they're going to be delayed in rolling out Sandy Bridge machines on their floors. So it's too bad because a lot of people were really excited about Sandy Bridge. The announcement was made right before CES started. And it's hit a big bump here.
Brian Shrout and I spent a lot of time talking about this on Twits this week, Computer Hardware this week. On one hand, it's a huge deal for Intel because they have to spend a lot of money replacing a lot of chipsets or a lot of motherboards effectively and notebooks. You know, if you actually already have a Sandy Bridge device, don't panic. It's essentially a potential problem showing up on the 3 gigabit SATA ports on the motherboard. You know, if you're really paranoid, switch your stuff to the 6 gigabit SATA ports, you'll be fine. A lot of it's still being worked out, and a lot of what we're hoping is vendors decide to do, you know, they take your credit card number, they fire out a fresh functional system or motherboard to you, and then they release the hold in your credit card or however they want to do it when you send the RMA back on your old motherboard. It's really messy because it came out of nowhere. Intel verified it over the found out, verified it over the weekend, released it immediately on Monday, and it really came out of left field. Nothing anyone expected. One of their motherboard partner found it during extensive sort of heat and stress testing, but Intel verified it and immediately said, you know, we'll cover the costs. What that turns out to be, if it is going to include shipping or other things, we don't really know yet. So each of the vendors are kind of working this out, and I'm sure they're all working this out with Intel and how they're going to cover the expense of this. But it's a pretty big slowdown in the rollout of Sandy Bridge.
I know it only affects ports 2 through 5, so if you're only using two SATA ports, ports 0 and 1, you're okay. But even if you're only using 2, shouldn't you get the working one just in case you need those other ports down the road somewhere?
Yeah, you will get the working one, you know, unless you sort of, you know, bought your Sandy Bridge secondhand and didn't turn in any kind of warranty card. Yes, you
black
should
market Sandy Bridge.
Well, I mean, you know, if you contact your vendor, whether it's a big PC vendor or if you built it yourself, your motherboard vendor, yes, you do want to replace it. It's just that the likelihood of any data corruption happening over the 3 gigabit SATA port is relatively minor. You know, yes, you absolutely do want to eventually replace the motherboard. You know, that's going to happen over the next few weeks. But it's I think it's a big, you know, Intel's got the money. They said they'll cover it. Do it. You know, call your vendor, find out how to do it. But you will want to replace your motherboard. It's just it's very unlikely that very many people are going to be impacted by this. We think.
We hope.
They think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That does it for us. Thanks, everybody, for watching live on the Super Bowl Sunday. We had a lot more people in the chat room than I expected. And thanks to everybody who's downloading and watching it later as well. I hope your team won. I hope all teams win. Why don't they do it like in kids soccer, where they just give everybody a trophy? Who cares? Harry McCracken, editor of Technologizer and a contributor to Time magazine and website, both. Thank you so much. Let people know where they can find Technologizer and all the other stuff you do on the internet.
Check me out at technologizer.com, and every Thursday look for my Technologizer column on time.com.
Danny Sullivan, thank you so much for being here to explain what was going on with Google Bing. I highly recommend going to searchengineland.com, not just to read all the great articles they have there, but specifically if you're interested in more about Google Bing, he has a couple of really good write-ups that go into detail about what's happening. Thank you so much for being on the show, Danny, and let people know more about Search Engine Land and where they can find your stuff on the net.
Sure. We're at searchengineland.com, and we have information about how to search better, things that are going on in the search engine industry, as well as search marketing advice as well. So hope people enjoy the content if they make it out there. And thanks for having me today. I enjoyed it.
No problem. Patrick Norton, host of TechZilla. You can find it, well, it's daily and weekly, right?
Daily and weekly. Veronica does a daily tip every day. You can find it at revision3.com/TechZilla, T-E-K-Z-I-L-L-A. And, of course, we do two weekly shows, Veronica Belmont, Robert Heron, and I. And we get hands-on and geeky as much as possible with computers and occasionally other technology.
You can also spy Patrick on This Week in Computer Hardware.
Yes. Right here on the Twit Network.
I'm Tom Merritt, host of Tech News Today, which you can find daily at 5:30 Eastern, 2:30 Pacific, right here on Twit. I'll be filling in for Leo Laporte on This Week in Tech, not only today, as you already know, but the next 2 weeks as well, until he gets back from his trip to Antarctica. Thanks, everybody, for watching. In That Can is another amazing Twit.